Okay, if you'd like to take the Bibles that should be in the back of your chairs and turn to page 972, and that should bring you to New Testament, into Matthew's Gospel. And we're actually starting a new series between now and Easter. And we're going to be in this Gospel of Matthew, and we're focusing upon two particular chapters 8 and 9. And as this is the opening talk in the series, I'm just going to start by briefly saying something about the Gospel, and then briefly something about the person who wrote it, in order just to give us a bit of background before we, over the coming weeks, look at these two chapters. Okay, let me quote to you the opening sentence. This is the opening sentence of Matthew's Gospel. It says, "A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David." Now, Matthew, in his first sentence, in a sense, sets the tone as to what his focus is going to be in his Gospel, because Jesus, in the first sentence, is immediately identified with the royal throne of David. And throughout the rest of this Gospel, the portrait that Matthew wants to, in a sense, paint for us about Christ, and each Gospel's got, a different emphasis, but Matthew's is that Christ is king. Christ is king. One of the outstanding features of Matthew's Gospel is the reference of the word kingdom. Comes time and time again, lots of teaching in Matthew's Gospel about the kingdom of God. And central to that is this theme that Jesus is king. His business was to come and set up a kingdom and then to exercise authority as king in that kingdom. So we're going to keep coming back to this in this series. One really distinctive feature of Matthew's Gospel is that there are lots of references from the Old Testament scriptures. It's got more than any other gospel. And Matthew does this because when he was writing primarily for Jewish readers. And so he quotes the Old Testament time and time again because he wants to underline that Jesus Christ was indeed the promised Messiah and that he did fulfill all the promises and prophecies that we find about him in the Old Testament. That's a very broad brushstroke of where Matthew's coming from when he writes this Gospel. What of Matthew himself? Well, interestingly, nowhere in the four Gospels do we find a single word that Matthew spoke. But what he does do, he does record his encounter with Jesus and how he became a disciple. That's actually in chapter 9, so we've got it at some point in our series. But let me tell you now that it's a wonderful example when Matthew comes to Christ of the grace of God. Matthew had been a tax collector. And because he was a tax collector, he was among the most hated group of people within Jewish society at that time. Tax collectors worked for the Roman enemy, and on the back of that power and protection they got, they exploited, and they basically robbed their own people. They were, if you like, considered the equivalent of a thief and a traitor. And they were treated as being religiously unclean and as complete outcasts. Jesus was known, or rather, let's say this, Jesus was accused by the religious leaders as being a friend of tax collectors and sinners. It wasn't a compliment when they called him that. We read that now and think, oh, that's a compliment. When they said Jesus is a friend of tax collectors and sinners, it wasn't meant to be a compliment. And we read that Jesus chose to befriend Matthew, and he ate with him. And Matthew left his old way of life to follow Christ. And on doing so, his name was changed from Levi to Matthew. And Matthew means gift of God. Now, I find this a really sort of beautiful feature of the Gospel. As Levi, the tax collector, he had sunk to the bottom of the pile as far as his fellow Israelites were concerned. He would have been despised. He would have been rejected. When he met with Jesus, his life changed and he had his name changed. And from that point, Matthew was a gift of God to others. And to what greater dignity could anyone aspire than to be called that? Something very briefly about how this Gospel is structured, and this is, bear with me, because this is actually relevant to our series. Maybe because Matthew had been accustomed to keeping systematic records when he was a tax collector. What he does, he gives us a brilliantly organised account of Jesus' life and ministry. The whole book can be divided into 10 sections. Simply put, doing and teaching alternate with each other in each of those sections. In the first section, that's chapters 1 to 4, we're introduced to Jesus, who's the promised Messiah. We have the account of his birth. We have the flight to Egypt. We have the return to Nazareth. We have the start of his public ministry with his baptism by John the Baptist. We have the account of when Jesus is tested and tempted in the wilderness. We have the calling of the first disciples. It's a really fast-paced narrative. There's lots of action. Then there's the first block of teaching, and that's in chapters 5 to 7, which we know as the Sermon on the Mount. Then we get to chapters 8 and 9, which is the focus of our series. And we have another block of action when there are 10 miracles that are recorded for us. So can we see there's a pattern there? We have action, then we have teaching, then we have action again. And following the account of what Jesus taught on the Sermon on the Mount, we then have an account of what he can actually do. Before we read the first healing miracle that's recorded for us by Matthew, I'm just going to read the last couple of verses of chapter 7. Because if you like, this gives us a transition between the teaching that has just gone and then the action that follows. So this is chapter 7, 972, and verses 28 and 29. Jesus has just finished the Sermon on the Mount. Don't worry, I'm not going to try and sum that up in 5 minutes. But after he'd finished this amazing sermon, the most amazing sermon ever spoke, it says this. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. Crowds were amazed. The Greek word for amazed is the same word we get our word dumbfounded from when you're like, you're speechless. So you have this image after this sermon, they're so amazed, they're dumbfounded, they're speechless at how Jesus has taught them. Why? Well, it says he taught as one who had authority, unlike the other teachers at that time. When Jesus got up to teach, there were no think tanks alongside to help him. And unlike the other teachers of the time, he never referred to what others had said and who he had learned from. Other teachers would get up and quote another teacher and say they learned from them. Jesus never did that. Instead, he repeatedly said this, I say to you, I say to you. Jesus needed no human teacher to add authority to his words. Why? Because he spoke as the Son of God. We then move from the great sermon in chapters 5 to 7 and unto chapters 8 and 9. One thing that you can never say about Jesus is this, that he was all talk and no action. And Matthew seeks to underline this brilliantly. You see, up to this point in the gospel, if you like, we've had the person of the king in chapters 1 and 4. We're introduced to Jesus. Then we have the principles of the king in chapters 5 to 7. And then, as we're going to discover over the coming weeks, we've got the power of the king in chapters 8 and 9. And the sermon that went before, the Sermon on the Mount, has a lot of challenges and does present big choices before us. Chapters 8 and 9 concentrate on challenging the reader, which is going to be us, with one single critical question, and it's this. Who is this Jesus? Who is this Jesus? Chapter 8 opens with 3 miraculous healings where the authority of God is clearly manifest. Not now in his preaching, he had authority when he preached, but now his authority is in his mighty deeds. So let's read the first miracle, and that's in verses 1 to 4. And as we do, let's be aware that actually Matthew chooses this particular miracle as the first one he records for us. It wasn't that actually the first miracle Jesus did, because we know from John's gospel it's turning water into wine, but Matthew, as I say, he selects this one as the first one he wants to record for us. And there's a dramatic, significant appropriateness. That is the cleansing of the man with leprosy. And hopefully we'll see why this can speak to us all this morning. So, Matthew 8, verses 1 to 4. Let's read this together. When he came down from the mountainside, large crowds followed him. A man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said. "Be clean." Immediately he was cured of his leprosy. And then Jesus said to him, "See that you don't tell anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them." Okay, let's think about this encounter. Let's also think about why Matthew chooses this healing of the leper of his first miracle he wants to record. Now, I'm presuming we're all aware of leprosy as a disease. And I'm also actually presuming that none of us here have been affected by it. Thankfully, we live in a time where it's now curable and its prevalence is shrinking around the world. I was surprised. I read a book last summer. It was a novel called The Island. It was a novel, but it was set on an island that did actually exist called Spinalonga, which was a real leper colony in Greece, which was there up to the mid-1950s. I was sort of surprised how long people still had leprosy in Europe, but it was there up to the mid-1950s. And this island was where anyone with leprosy was immediately placed. It was a heartbreaking place. So if your child got leprosy and you were the parent, the child was whisked away and sent on this island. If you were the parent of that child, you were just taken on that day and put on that island. It was a remarkable sort of place. In the time of Jesus, leprosy was both incurable and it was also common. It's a contagious disease that was thought to be transferred at that time merely by touch, which meant the leper not only had a terrible physical disease that was manifest with terrible sores, ulcers and limbs decaying and literally in the end falling off, but a leper also had to endure rejection and complete isolation from the community. Let me just read you this little excerpt from Philip Yancey's book, which I still would recommend, The Jesus I Never Knew. And Philip Yancey once wrote a book with someone called Dr. Paul Brand, who worked in India among leprosy patients for many years. And I'll just read you this. It says, "You can view disease as a mechanical breakdown of bodily cells, or you can view it in a broader sense as a state of dis-ease involving body, mind and soul. I learned this from the patients of Dr. Paul Brand, the leprosy specialist whose books I have co-authored. Except in very early stages, the leprosy patient does not feel physical pain. That, in fact, is the problem. After leprosy bacilli deaden nerve cells, patients no longer alert to danger proceed to damage their own bodies. A leprosy patient may walk all day on a sharp metal screw or use a splintery hammer or scratch an infected spot of the eyeball. Each of these acts destroys tissues and may eventually lead to loss of limb or vision. But at no point does the leprosy patient actually hurt. Though they may not hurt, leprosy patients surely suffer as much as any people I have ever known. Almost all the pain they feel comes from the outside, for it is the pain of rejection imposed on them by the surrounding community. Dr. Brand told me of one bright young man he was treating in India. In the course of the examination, Dr. Brand laid his hand upon the patient's shoulder and informed him through a translator of the treatment that lay ahead. To his surprise, the man began to shake with muffled sobs. "Have I said something wrong?" Dr. Brand asked his translator. She quizzed the patient in a spurt of Tamil and reported, "No, doctor. He says he is crying because you put his hand on his shoulder. Until he came here, no one had touched him for many, many years." Now, the fact that leprosy involved both pain and this terrible stigma actually meant it was the most dreaded disease throughout the Bible. They called it the dreaded skin disease. People dreaded getting leprosy. In the Old Testament, there are only two accounts of people with leprosy being healed. There's lots of leprosy in the Old Testament. Only two accounts of people who had leprosy who were healed. One man and one woman. The woman was who? Anyone know who the woman was? Well done, John. I should also say, except for John, because you always get it. It was Moses' sister, Miriam. The man? Naaman. He's a bit more famous. Naaman the Syrian. Now, they're actually two very different stories, if you read them. But what they both had in common is that both were actually healed by divine intervention. There's nothing that the medics or family or money, in the case of Naaman, he was very rich and powerful, but money and wealth could not bring any healing or any change to the condition. I also find it interesting that, as far as I can work out, there are only two accounts of people being raised from the dead in the Old Testament. So we have two cases of people being cured of leprosy, two cases being raised from the dead in the Old Testament. Let's be honest, for either to happen, it has to be an act of God. In both those cases, no human hope of either of those conditions being reversed. With this in mind, can we grasp how stunning and how significant this healing is? We're told that the large crowds had followed Jesus after the Sermon on the Mount, and suddenly this man with leprosy is kneeling before Jesus. Have you thought how this man managed to reach Jesus through those great crowds? I think it would have been very easy. He would have just walked through because everyone would have jumped out of his way. There is, I think, significance that this terrible disease actually gave him direct access to Jesus. And then we have this dramatic encounter when Jesus reaches out and does something that no one would ever dare to do. Must have shocked the crowd, isn't this? He touches the leper. And immediately, even more shocking, the man is healed. Now, for those who witnessed that, what would it have said to the crowd, and maybe also to us reading this account this morning? Quite simply, it's this, that Jesus has the power and the authority of God. Right at the outset, Matthew in this first miracle saying, look, this is the king. This is the king with authority over something like leprosy, which no human has authority over. Where else does the power to instantly heal a leper come from? After Jesus has healed this leper, he then gives him a specific instruction that actually for us may seem strange, but is important in understanding, I think, the significance of this healing. And also, I think, I'll get to this at the end, so bear with me, the connection with us this morning. It says in verse 4, Jesus heals him, and then verse 4 says this, then Jesus said to him, see that you don't tell anyone. But go, I always think that's funny because everyone's watched it, but anyway, see that you don't tell anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them. Now remember that line there, he says, go to the priest and as a testimony to them, you know, do the gift that Moses commanded. What's this all about? Well, to understand this instruction, we need to know how leprosy was treated in the Old Testament. So we need to go right back. Need to go right back when the Israelites came out of slavery, crossed the Red Sea, and then started wandering in the wilderness. When they were in the wilderness and they were destined to be there for a whole generation, what they did was they set up camp and they lived in tents. And in the middle of this camp was always the tabernacle, which was the dwelling of God. And it was like a representation that God was right in the center of everything that was going on. Not only was God present in the tabernacle in a special way, but his presence was also in the camp. And anything deemed to be unclean was not allowed in this camp. Leprosy, as a disease, was deemed to be unclean. If someone was suspected of having leprosy, they were immediately brought to the priest who examined them. And there was all these examinations. If you want to, got time today, you can read all about it in Leviticus 13 and 14. It's really interesting reading all these things the priest had to do to examine this leper. If they were found to have leprosy, then this is what had to happen. You need to look this up. It's Leviticus 13 verse 45. And it says, the person with such an infectious disease must wear torn clothes, let his hair be unkempt, cover the lower part of his face, and cry out, unclean, unclean. As soon as he has the infection, he remains unclean. He must live alone and he must live outside the camp. Now, given that there's no cure for leprosy, there was no cure for leprosy then, that is a desperate situation, isn't it? That is a hopeless situation. You've got leprosy, you live outside the camp on your own. But you read on Leviticus 14, it's funny, if a cure is found, or maybe there's divine intervention, the next chapter in Leviticus tells us how this man is able to come back into the camp. What happens is, I'll sum it up for you, okay? But if you've got time today, read Leviticus 14. The priest goes out to the person. There's this long ritual ceremony involving two live clean birds, some cedar wood, scarlet yarn, hyssop, fresh water, and a clay pot. All the details are there in Leviticus 14. If the person is deemed to have recovered, then he's brought back into the camp and he has to spend 7 days washing and shaving until eventually he's brought to the entrance of the tent of the meeting. Then we read, the priest has to bring a sin offering. What do you think that was? He has to bring something as a sin offering to atone for this leper to be brought back in. Not a bird, it was a male lamb. First time I've ever caught John out. We're told it was a male lamb to be slaughtered. And then after this lamb is slaughtered, we're told that the blood was to be put on the ear, the hand, the foot of the one who had to be cleansed. Then there's this instruction. It says, then the priest is to sacrifice the sin offering and make atonement for the one to be cleansed from his uncleanliness. After that, the priest shall slaughter the burnt offering and offer it on the altar together with the grain offering and then make an atonement for him, and then he will be clean. Can we make some connections here between what's happening there in that camp back in Leviticus and maybe what's happening here with Jesus coming, the king? After Jesus healed the leper, he sent him to the priest so that the man could now formally move from being regarded as being unclean and an outsider to being cleansed and coming back into the community. Now, I would love to have seen the face of the priest on that day, who had to examine the leper and then declare him clean. It would have been a completely new experience for him to declare a leper to be now clean. And that priest, in line with Leviticus and all the law of Moses, would still have to carry out all those tests and rituals and then decide if the man was in or out, clean or unclean. Now, here's a question. If that man had not been touched by Jesus and not been healed and still had leprosy, what would all that ritual do for him? He goes to the priest and the priest goes through all this ritual. What would that do for him? The answer is simple. Absolutely nothing. The ritual itself had no power to bring healing and transformation. You see, the law of Moses just showed you where you stood, whether you were clean or whether you were unclean. In a sense, whether you were in or whether you were out. And if you're found wanting and you're deemed to be out, then you are stuck there with no power to change it. Can we see the significance of this miracle? It's this. What the law could never do, Jesus could. The law had no power to heal a leper and make him clean, but Jesus did. The leper, through no works of his own, but by the power, authority, and by the grace of God, is brought back in, and because of Jesus, and only because of Jesus, he is no longer an outsider. When the leper arrived at that synagogue that day, what did he give testimony to? You remember Jesus said, you go there and give testimony to me, in a sense. It was a testimony to the power and the compassion of Christ. But it was also, I think significantly for the priests, it was a testimony that one greater than Moses had now come. The one who was promised in Scripture had now arrived. The prophecies that pointed to the king were now realized. This was evidence of the law was now being fulfilled in a person. The leper, if you like, that day testified that a new era had come and everything now was changing. In a spiritual sense, this healed leper was actually carrying a redundancy note for the priests in the temple. Their time of sacrifice and ritual was actually now coming to an end. Why? Because the one who's come to fulfill all that had arrived, the king. And I want to suggest to all of us here this morning that that all of us actually can relate to, and I think actually be challenged by, this unnamed leper at the beginning of chapter 8. Why do I say this? Well, in the Bible, there's not a disease that caused such misery and separation as leprosy. What does it actually mirror to us? Well, it actually mirrors, spiritually speaking, the effects of sin. Consider the way that sin separates us from God. It actually separates us from each other. It causes desperate misery in people's lives. And ultimately, if it's not dealt with, what happens? It leads to death. It's significant that the leper in this story asks to be made clean rather than healed. With the sin in our lives, we need to be cleansed, don't we? But how is that possible? Is it through keeping the law of God perfectly? Is it through carrying out all the religious rituals we read about? The great problem is we can't keep the law of God even near perfectly. And no religious ritual is ever able to cleanse us within. I want to suggest, like the leper, our only hope with our sin is to come humbly and expectantly to Jesus. Why? Because Jesus has the power and he has the authority to make us clean and to forgive us of our sin. No one else has. For Jesus is actually willing to cleanse us, is able to cleanse us, because his mission was to come and usher in this new kingdom where belonging is now due to grace and it's not due to works. I want us just to learn from the attitude of the leper to finish. Think of what that leper does. He goes to Jesus. First thing he does is he kneels in front of him and he calls him Lord. That kneeling is an indication of his submission to the Lordship of Christ, recognizing his authority and his kingship. Then he shows his trust and faith by declaring, "You can make me clean." He'd seen enough, this leper, to say to Jesus, "I know you can make me clean." And interestingly, in between the two statements, he says something I find very challenging. He says, "If you're willing." So he kneels in front of Jesus and he says, "Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean." This leper believed Jesus could heal him. But interestingly, he didn't presume or demand it. In other words, he trusted Jesus for whatever Jesus chose to do. And faith does not prejudge what he may do. It's the attitude of trust that allows him to do whatever he may choose to do by whatever means he may choose to do it. If for some good reason God permits us to remain sick, or if he chooses to heal, that is always his business. Faith in God always allows God to be God. And if we live by faith, what we're doing, we're living with the certainty that his will be accomplished. And whether that involves miraculous intervention or not, faith always has confidence in his ability, but also a readiness to let him work according to his own agenda and to his own purpose. How God works in our circumstances is always his business, but the reality of his working is actually always in response to our faith. When the leper came and said, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean," he was in effect saying this: "I know you are able. I know what I want. I want to be healed, but only if you are willing." And I feel where he challenges us is in his submission and his humility and his faith. And he has much to teach us. And of course, isn't it wonderful? What did Jesus say to him? "I am willing. I am willing." And he did heal him. And Matthew, I think, records this miracle for us to affirm right at the outset of chapter 8, and we're going to come across this time and again over the coming weeks, that this Jesus is the promised king. And he's the promised king who we can trust and who has the authority to bring forgiveness and has the authority to bring cleansing for us all. And if he is the king, then I say, let us come now, but let us come in thanks and submission, in humility, but in confidence that he is able and he is willing to touch us this morning. And if we want to be cleansed, Jesus will do that. Let's just pray, and then we're going to sing a song. Lord, we want to come now individually and corporately, and like that leper at that time, we want to come humbly and kneel before you, proclaim that you are Lord, praying that you are able to cleanse, and that really to say individually and corporately, we want your touch upon our lives so that we can know, like that leper did that day, your power at work in us. And for each of us, if there's areas where we know we need cleansing, help us to know that we can come now and know that cleansing, because that's what you're promising. You are willing to touch and cleanse us this morning. And we thank you for that. Amen.